Woodward, the Cratchit, Congressman, the other distinguished guests, visitors, my fellow Americans and fellow Marylanders. Now, my friends, we are gathered here today to celebrate the adoption of the United States Constitution on September 17, 1787, and to renew our vows of fealty to the great heritage which that Constitution embodied. In the intervening span of a century and two-thirds, much has happened to test the soundness of this Constitution. Events here and abroad have served only to strengthen our attachment to its principles, differ though we may in the interpretation and the application of the Constitution. That document has been pored over by generations of men, and both it and the decisions construing it are the basic material not only for lawyers, but for students of history, sociology, political science, economics, and philosophy. Now, my friends, there are cautions in the interpretation of constitutional history, as there are passions in other things. And passions, as you know, are forever changing. A few years ago, an eminent historian wrote a book to expound his theory that the framers of the Constitution were not really the great and good men we have thought, but that they were only a group of selfish, rich men with an eye to securing the economic interests of their class. This thesis proved popular with some students, and for a time at least, they thought it was fashionable to speak in this vein. At the other end of the spectrum are those who read history entirely differently, who look upon the members of the Constitutional Convention as an inspired band of idealists, altogether free from error, passion, self-interest, or other human frailties. People who are inclined to this view accord to the Constitution of the United States and to its every thought and word a sanctity ordinarily reserved for no other work of human beings. Indeed, a famous feminine religious leader once linked God and the Constitution as the pillars of her faith. Well, we need not go into the various theories of constitutional rights. The discussion may interest the theorist, but practical, everyday citizens, like you and I, are little interested in the startling pronouncements of scholars or theorists. I venture to suggest that the generality of Americans will be little swayed by such contributions to constitutional learning, and that they will make some shrewd judgments of their own, which I should be more inclined to trust. As for myself, I prefer the testimony of an eyewitness, a participant in the Constitutional Convention of Philadelphia. He is a witness of the highest integrity, whose wisdom and patriotism are beyond challenge. I take from our text today the words of Benjamin Franklin, a human immortal, if there ever was one. When the Constitution had labored for 5 months, and the delegates beheld what their earnest and their time-heated debates had wrought, some were so disappointed that they withheld their consent. Others, conscious of the many defects on matters that they thought vital, nevertheless perceived that more was to be gained by accepting less than they desired than by permitting their efforts to be wrecked in a stalemate. It was then that the elders, and perhaps the sages of them, Dr. Franklin, made a brief but now famous speech. It's the only utterance of that convention whose publication is sanctioned. In it, Franklin spoke golden words freighted with wisdom for the ages. He said, "I confess that there are several points of this Constitution which I do not at present approve. But I'm not sure that I shall never approve them. For having lived long, I have experienced many instances of being obliged by better information or fuller consideration to change opinions, even on important subjects, which I once thought right but found to be otherwise. It is, therefore, that the older I grow, the more apt I am to doubt my own judgment and to pay attention to the judgment of others. Most men, indeed, as well as most sects in religion, think themselves in possession of all truth. But though many private persons think almost as highly of their infallibility as that of their sect, a few only can express it as so natural as a certain French lady who, in a dispute with her sister, said, 'I don't know how it happened, sister, but I meet with nobody but myself that's always in the right.' In these sentiments, sir," Franklin continued, "I agree to this Constitution with all its faults. I doubt, too, whether any other convention we can obtain may be able to make a better Constitution. For when you assemble a number of men to have the advantage of their joint wisdom, you inevitably assemble bristle men. All their prejudices, their passions, their errors of opinion, their local interests, and their selfish views. The opinions I have had of its errors, I sacrifice to the public good. I cannot help expressing a wish that every member of the convention, who may still have objections to it, would with me, on this occasion, doubt a little of his infallibility, and to make manifest our unanimity, put his name to this instance." So spoke Franklin. The same admonition came more than a century later from Justice Holmes, who reminded us that certitude is not the test of certainty. And Judge Landon Hand recently observe how tentative and provisional are our attainments, intellectual and moral. How often the deepest convictions of one generation are the reject of the next. Also, he says, most of the issues that mankind sets out to settle, it never does settle. The issue disappears because it is replaced by a compromise that, although not wholly acceptable to either side, offers a tolerable substitute for victory. Now, what distinguishes our Constitution, the Constitution that we reverence, from other documents of state? Lofty ideals of government were not newly discovered in the convention at Philadelphia. Philosophers through the ages had formulated them, and rulers had occasionally honored them in practice. Many of the ideas of the Constitution were directly borrowed from England. It's a satisfaction to note John Adams' acknowledgement in his memoir that the Constitution of Maryland was an important source. But nowhere, and at no time, have these principles been gathered together and comprehensively embodied in the basic law of a nation with the aim of protecting it by every known device against despotism. Nowhere do we find so careful an enumeration of limitations on government. Recognize that the citizen has rights which government itself may not invade, and that the law is above the officers of the government as well as above the government. You will remember that many of the delegates and the people in the 13 colonies were not content merely to erect a structure with a system of checks and balances to restrict the power of officials. They insisted upon more. They wanted specific guarantees of freedom, and these were incorporated in a Bill of Rights and made a part of the Constitution within 3 years. And what are these? Freedom of religion, the press, and peaceable assembly, freedom from unreasonable searches of citizens' persons, homes, and effects, protection against cruel and unusual punishment. These guarantees are the most precious promises of the Constitution, and the rest is but the mechanical structure to safeguard them.
A moment upon these guarantees, and you will quickly perceive that insistence upon them was not the prompting of abstract political philosophy, but it was a product of the colonial's own bitter experience with tyrannical power, which in turn mirrors in turn the hard lessons taught by the long history of America. Consider also the happenings of our day. Is there a single one of these rights which we consider so essential to freedom and to human dignity that has not been marked and trampled upon by tyrants, regardless of the color of the shirts in which they are garbed? Or is not freedom totally hurt when exposed to unrestrained power, be it Nazi or fascist or communist? The barbarism which flared in Germany for a decade or more, the violence and wretchedness in Russia and the satellite countries behind the Iron Curtain, these are daily reminders to us of the degradations and the calamities that come inevitably from unbridled power. And they remind us also that all power, even in the hands of good men, tends to become unbridled and arbitrary. Nothing influenced the founders of our nation so powerfully as the determination to check and limit power and to subordinate it to law. The idea is embodied in the words which appear above the entrance to the United States Supreme Court: justice under law. The highest spiritual glory of our constitutional system is, therefore, this very insistence upon individual liberty, not as it may be accorded by powerful officials, however gracious, but as commanded by the supreme law of the land. Now, when we turn to the specific arrangement in the structure of government constitutionally provided, we note another important attitude which pervaded the convention. Lord Bryce wrote of our Constitution, "It was and remains what its authors styled it, eminently an instrument of compromise. It is perhaps the most successful instance in history of what a judicious spirit of compromise may affect." Due to unfavorable semantic connotations, The word compromise has now fallen upon unhappy days. And yet, my friends, we know that compromise remains a prime method of resolving problems in practical affairs. The historic genius of the Anglo-Saxons for compromise has been noted and commented on repeatedly, always with great respect. In every age, men of real statesmanship, with the object of unity and effectiveness, have been willing to make compromises and to stand by them and not snarl and splutter endlessly. What makes the Russian business so perplexing is that this spirit of accommodation is so completely absent in their negotiations. Even upon proposed minor and temporary organizational arrangements, their delegate from the United Nations announces, "The word compromise is not in the Soviet glossary on this issue." How foreign in spirit is this intransigence from the temper that prevailed in the deliberations of those men whose product we signalize today. It is not often, indeed, that uncompromisable principles are at stake in governmental affairs. More often, so-called principle is stubbornly asserted as a bar to concession and adjustment, when nothing more is at issue than the willfulness of opponents. Again and again, the Constitution makers face seemingly irreconcilable differences. But by patient discussion and exploring the possibilities of adjustment, they compromised upon workable arrangements reasonably acceptable to all. Some of the 55 delegates were from large colonies, others from small ones. Some came from agricultural communities, others from those that lived on commerce and shipping. There were Catholics and Protestants. There were Englishmen and Dutchmen, Huguenots and Germans. There were slaveholders and those who held the institution of slavery in abomination. They came from places as distant as New England and Georgia. And some had to travel longer to reach Philadelphia, the central point, than it takes us today to circle the globe. There was every manner of diversity in geography, in interest, in speech and custom. And yet, because they were deeply concerned to discover the elements of unity rather than division, they exalted the common purpose, subordinated differences, and subjected them to the process of compromise. In this spirit, a difficult obstruction to the union of the great and the small states was overcome. Contrary to the suggestion of Franklin himself and others that Congress should consist of a single house, they established the bicameral system with which we are familiar, thereby enabling them to accord to each state, regardless of size, equal representation in the Senate, and representation according to population in the House of Representatives. Even in computing the population as a basis for representation and for direct taxation, a notable compromise is apparent in the provision that apportionment shall be made after adding to the whole number of free persons 3/5 of all other persons. Now it would be difficult to suggest any principle of logic upon which to predicate this fraction. Yet as a formula of compromise, it proved acceptable, and considering its effectiveness in furthering the establishment of the Union, it is nothing less than admirable. So too, they effected compromises with regard to the presidential veto. and the distribution of powers among the Congress, the President, and the courts, and between the national government and the state, and the decision to tolerate the importation of slaves for 20 years and no longer, and the device of the Electoral College, an instance where history has overruled the plan of the framers. The same is true of the hot debate concerning the assumption of the public debt and the rivalries involving the Northwest Territory. These and many others were triumphs of statesmanship through the art of mutual concession. When the men of 1787 finished their writing, that was far from the end of the process. Since then, continuously, to our day, there has been, and after us, there will continue, the unending process of interpretation, application, accommodation, as long as the nation endures. There is necessarily, and will be, conflict and workable resolution of conflict, struggle and give and take. There is and will be the eternal problems of liberty and justice, of control by government and control of government, of taxation and the direction of economic and social policy. The step taken in the Prohibition Amendment and later retraced in the Repeal Amendment is only one example of the flow and ebb of public thinking and action. The very scope of government is fuel for perennial debate. There is also the colossal but inevitable task of educating our youth to meet the responsibilities of free men. We shall never be wholly free from problems that attend governmental procedure, judicial and administrative, and the discovery, and perhaps from time to time revision, of lines of demarcation between state and nation, between legislative and executive, between judge and administrator. Not in the foreseeable future will foreign policy become simple, or the matter of defense against foreign enemies and likely also of protection against enemies within become less acute. So also the delicate question of vigilance to preserve our liberties from misguided persons at both extremes. In all these concerns, which may be summed up as the problem of making democracy work, our course is far from clear, and our path, we recognize, is beset with obstacles and dangers. There are forces which challenge the very concept of democracy, proclaiming strange dogmas. But in the last analysis, the answer will be provided by our fitness to govern ourselves. And in all this, the spirit and the principle which guided the men of 1787 afford us guidance and hope. In the final speech to the Constitutional Convention, which I have quoted, Benjamin Franklin uttered another never to be forgotten sentiment. He declared that the newly adopted form of government could only end in despotism, as other forms have done before it, if the people should become so corrupt as to need despotic government, being incapable and unworthy of any other. We dare not forget that unless the spirit of liberty and the passion for justice are in the hearts of the people, no document or other human device can protect them against loss of their liberty. Words of a constitution that find no echo in the hearts of the people
are hollow. It is only necessary to recall that in Argentina and Brazil and other countries, they have copied our Constitution practically word for word. But what a difference the spirit and the bent of those people has imparted to their constitutions in practical operation. This we may say without reflection on our neighbors, but we may note that they are different, and these differences emerge despite the fact that there is a sameness in their and our constitutional formula. In a democracy, public opinion is the mainspring of action. Public opinion may for a time be confused or inarticulate. It may be checked, but it cannot be forever denied. It's essential, therefore, that for the successful operation of a democracy, the sources of public opinion must be kept informed and free and uncorrupted. This, too, is implicit in the Constitution's guarantee of the freedom of the press, which is in reality an aspect of freedom of speech. Though this freedom, like any other, is sometimes abused, we must remember that it exists and is protected not out of solicitude for the individuals who happen to exercise it, but for the benefit of the whole society. Whatever its occasional misuse, this is of little account compared to the evils to be feared from repression, for whatever reasons and motives.
That the preservation of freedom is the business of every citizen has been recognized again and again, but never more simply or more eloquently than by Chief Justice Hughes. "We have in this country," he said, "but one security. You may think the Constitution is your security. It's nothing but a piece of paper. You may think that the statutes are your security. They are nothing but words in a book. You may think that the elaborate mechanism of government is your security. It's nothing at all unless you have sound and uncorrupted public opinion to give life to your Constitution, to give vitality to your statutes, to make efficient your government machinery." Franklin used his great prestige with his colleagues in the convention and with the people in the colonies to teach them the wisdom of moderation and conciliation in important affairs. What lessons do his words have for our generation? The lesson for us is the same. We, too, are in need of his counsel of restraint and mutual forbearance in public debate and action. And it's needed most when we are dead sure we are wholly right and our neighbor wholly wrong. This does not mean that we should be soft-headed in dealing with treason, but it calls for self-discipline and awareness that democracy itself implies opportunity for the interplay of diversities of opinion, of culture and ideals, and that the utmost tolerance should never be denied to sincere thoughts or proposals merely because they're unpopular.
Our Constitution has survived longer than any other written Constitution, because it has the necessary flexibility that makes it possible for this nation of men, free men, to meet its needs as they unfold. What the people strongly desire may be channeled to avoid error or injustice, or it may be delayed. Sometimes, indeed, perhaps, all along delayed. But the Constitution does not stifle aspirations which the people in their genius evolve. It's not mere rhetoric, but sober proof to say that it is a living document capable of adaptation by succeeding generations to the varying conditions of life. It's a solemn reflection that whether we willed it or not, the hope of the world today lies in the hands of America and the present generation of Americans. The happy
happiness or the misery of the future is to be determined by the way in which we meet this grave responsibility. May we, all of us, be worthy of our sacred trust.